Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 205, Yoga, Bliss, and Mind.
What is the mind core? In the Buddhist subtle science, the mind core is the super subtle wind energy, which is the same thing as prana, but there's a super subtle non-atomic prana. And that's the mind core. And that's what they also call clear light of the void. It's also the eighth level of dissolution. When the ordinary being reaches that point, what happens is they disconnect from all of the aggregates of their previous existence, and that's actually the definition of death. Actually, in Buddhist science, it's when through those eight things that I mentioned last night, you get to the bottommost one. But that is the mind core, and the difference between unenlightened and enlightened, both enlightened and unenlightened have the same mind core. But the difference between enlightened and unenlightened is that enlightened is conscious of that mind core. So it can be conscious from a subatomic level, from the level where coarse reality, particles and atoms and so on, is shapeable by that pure energy that has no particles, but is much more powerful energy, like infinite energy. So that's the mind core. So, and it's, you know, words fail, mathematics formulas fail to really describe it because, as I think we said last night, although when you dissolve down into it, it's envisioned as if you reach the super microscopic, sub-microscopic level of the heart chakra center, sort of the super soul center, and then as if you were going and just completely detaching from all related relativities into like the microcosm, you could say. But then when you hit the microcosm, it's infinite. It's like a thing in quantum. The quantum, some of the more adventurous quantum people have a concept, which they call the zero-point quantum vacuum field, or something like that. They combine those words in various ways to sound more or less horrific and incomprehensible. And what they mean is this weird thing where a vacuum has infinite energy, mathematically, that they sort of, you know, their formulas and everything reads into saying that. It has infinite energy. Vacuum. It seems like a vacuum because the energy being infinite, it doesn't do anything. It's completely quiescent. But somehow anything that was consciously there could be both non-local and local, translocal and local both simultaneously. That's the Dharmakaya of the Buddha, what's called reality body of the Buddha. So mind core means Shri Kali Devi, Shri Devi, you know, Penden Lamo, Shri Kali Devi, Remati is one of another of her syllable names. She is consciously shaped herself. She's the energy of Tara, which is miracle working, compassionate, and blissful energy. But she can shape herself in the destructive and fierce form if need be, if something needs to be transformed in that way, you know, like destroyed. Because nothing's ever destroyed, it's just transformed. But on the material level, it seems to be destroyed. So that's why these verses have a Madhyamaka and an emptiness idea in the verses. That's we are very perceptive to ask about before we look at the other thing. You know, so mind core marks the four enlightened activities. The four enlightened activities are activities of pacification, increase or growth, domination, and destruction are the four enlightened activities. And rituals, you know, when they perform rituals, they can perform them in the different directions, the different colors associated with that, etc. You know, white, yellow, red, black, etc. And so that the mind core is expressed in these enlightened activities. And it doesn't exist somewhere else. In other words, it's not like absolute ultimate reality or the infinite energy of the vacuum is somewhere other than us. In other words, we are all of that. Like, you know, we go around like I'm like an old body, you know, with, you know, flesh and blood and veins and hair and bones and whatever. So I go around thinking I'm that. But then, you know, on a scientific model, I'm like a bunch of molecules. And then there are some selfish genes running around there, and there's one or two enlightened ones running up there, a little bit like in the armpit or something. And then you go down, and then they don't know what it is, because they don't know what that atom is. So then scientifically, there's a wave-particle paradox going on in my belly button. And then we obviously are all constituted of this pure light energy, which is kind of everywhere. But we are absolutely unconscious of that. And actually, if we have a flash of it, if we weren't expecting it, we might feel terribly threatened, like we're dying or something, or we're losing control, or we don't know what we are. It's very scary sort of area that one can get into. And of course, normally I'm comfortable in being a flesh and blood body. Suppose normally, though, unless I have an auto accident or I'm dying or whatever, sick. So that's what the mind core marks. So that, you know, we are acknowledging that you, Kali Devi, you are marked by, characterized by, you're characterized by being pure, clear light in action. In other words, you know, although it doesn't do anything, the clear light, we're not saying you are the clear light doing something, but you can do anything. You can make a miracle by drawing on the clear light in any particular relational context where something needs to be done that requires maybe a miracle. So the mind core doesn't exist elsewhere. It's not like your mind is not somewhere out of the universe. Your real mind. Your real mind is what is made of all these things that are going on, what constitutes it. And mind, understood in, you know, my mind, your personality, structured mind, doesn't even exist, really. It exists not. It's ultimate reality, inseparable you are, in other words. You are the absolute inseparable from absolute reality, although you manifest relatively without color or form. And you manifest like a magical illusion. So like magical illusion doesn't have coarse atoms, right? It's just like a vision or something. This idea, like energy has no mass, right, or something. But they all have that problem, those people. So that's an interesting thing, actually. That also leads to another interesting point. Things like the zero quantum point vacuum infinite energy field are sort of all kind of abstract things, like impersonal, like a mechanism or something, you know. Material, like an object, not normal material, but just an object. And whereas, in a way, what is in this infinite energy, what is the awareness of this infinite energy? Who is aware of that infinite energy? How do you access that infinite energy, for example, in your own meditation? From the highest level of Buddhist science, normally made esoteric, you know, they say that the only way you do it is through bliss. And what bliss means, you melt away from the boundary itself that you normally are experience and defend and protect and carry around and heal and stretch and fix and improve and whatever. And you there's a bliss of letting go of that. In a way, you know, there's a bliss of dying. People say when they come back from near-death experience that when they finally let go, it was very blissful. You know, when they were fighting, struggling to maintain, it was very blissful. People who have simulated experiences like that, and yogis, great yogis, report such a bliss when they transcend their personal structured boundary itself into either what they think of as the great self, or what Buddhists would call the great selflessness, or sometimes they even say the great self of selflessness, just to get rid of any kind of notion of contradiction. But that's a blissful experience. And the deities that you see, like male-female union deities, are showing a kind of metaphor or a symbol of that bliss, because in normal human life, a time of moving the boundary, it does happen in sexual experience to greater or lesser degrees, depending on people and how boundary they are insistent upon maintaining themselves and how paranoid they are about opening their boundaries. So that's but the bliss of death, or the bliss of entering the kind of clear light of the void, or the bliss of being voidness, or recognizing that you are voidness, meaning pure relativity, is much, much more powerful than that. So therefore, people who think Tantra is just sort of some hotshot way of having sex, that's not correct, although there actually may be some side benefits, they say. Next time, I'm looking forward to that. And so therefore, it's bliss that, truly saying, it's bliss that finds that one is made of this thing by being able to identify with oneself as a vast, you know, unboundaried being. And without losing any part of it, because it's vast and unbounded. So it doesn't mean that the person who experiences that, oh, this is impossible to explain in binary language, still feels themselves in a way, yet they feel they're everything else at the same time. And that brings a kind of bliss. And then that bliss is what turns into compassion automatically, because that bliss includes, because it's a vision of relativity, it sees the bliss in all the other beings at the same time. It doesn't see just bliss over here, because there's no boundary. So it sees everything, and inanimate objects, even concrete slab, or even artillery shell, or whatever it is all made of this bliss energy, shaped in whatever really weird way. And that's the vision of a Buddha. But then the sensitivity going with that expansive vision is that some sentient beings are not experiencing themselves as what they actually are. They are therefore deluded, they are ignorant, and that makes them suffer. That's the thing. So then she, being the great mother goddess, who therefore connects with what they call Dakini Jala, the network of Dakinis. The network of Dakinis is what sustains the world, actually, whether or not the president is male or female. And the female might be more in connection with that network of Dakinis, which is why Dalai Lama said we need more female leaders. The only one left was really usefully functioning is Angela. She better win this poll. I wish I could vote in Berlin, but I can't. And because they're aware of this Dakini Jala Sambharam, you know, then the mantra of Chakra Sambhara, the sort of Shiva, most Shiva-like Buddha form. Om Shiva Jai Hey Hey Ruru Kam Dakini Jala Sambharam Swaha. So the great joy of all the Dakinis, you know, the network of Dakini, Dakini Jala. Jala means like a net. But the foundation of it is emptiness. Relativity is the foundation. That's why we're talking about emptiness now. Because the idea of this, you know, when you practice the esoteric teachings, the one thing you cannot do is, or you have to be able to do, is to remove your sense of confidence about what you think of as the real reality. Like this reality, or meat space, what my friend Martin Perry Barlow calls meat space. You know, the sort of electronic frontier people, they call it meat space. In the lower, what are called the more preliminary tantras, they don't call it creation space, but actually all of the preliminary, sort of lower order of tantras, involves visualizing something in front of you. And so what you're doing is you're taking your routinized imagination. Because Buddhist epistemology says, you yourself, you're visualizing your beard, you're visualizing your own limbs, you're visualizing your meat space entity. We are imagining ourselves all the time. That's why we're tired at night, because you have to constantly imagine it all. And it's through the model of it that we imagine, that we transmit signals like wiggle your fingers, you know, and by being, and actually Hatha Yoga, Hatha, left, right, or right, left channel, Richard will correct me, I forgot which is which. You know, Hatha Yoga is a sort of, without putting one into the formal practice of it, involves re-envisioning one's muscles and legs and things, etc., in a sort of energy flow open pattern rather than the usual cramped thing. So that's a, but that's a small degree of what the advanced things are when you're dealing with your chakras and things where you really get into the actual formal tantra, where you sort of start working in your brain, in your subtle nervous system. Your whole body is your brain also, not just your head part. There's a lot of wetware in the head because four of the five senses are located in the head. But the other senses all over the surface of the body. So that's why there's more wetware there. But there was wetware all over the body. 72,000 nadis, or channels, they say, based on the number of petals of the lotuses in the different chakras that in most systems. There are different systems because it's software. It isn't like you can dissect yourself and find a lotus someplace, like creeping around under the Ganesha belly that Richard helps you find. you wouldn't find it if you dissected yourself. But there's a neural system there, and then you program that neural system with these different loads. That's why there are different systems. But to be able to do that with power and realistically, you have to undo the sense of realism of this, which we all are totally convinced. In meat space, we think this is just it. We're here in meat space, and that's it. And even vegetarians are here in meat space, according to them. It was their own meat, you know. They're feeding with vegetables. Right? So, and of course, there's a role. But what is the body? As I just said, what we really are is this light. We're all light. And then what is light? They don't know because it goes everywhere. Its mass becomes infinite when it gets going. And that's what we are. And we don't even have particles. We all have Buddha bodies. When they say Buddha bodies have no particles, they mean that he himself is conscious of that. We are not conscious of that. We're identifying at a level where it's more solid. Although, that also may be by design of the network of Dakinis, actually. Why? When you go in meditation, a sensitive person who feels pain upon merely stubbing their toe on the side of the door or something, you know, or a piece of furniture. When we get in meditation in these planes of quite blissful, because there are orders and orders of bliss, and sort of golden realms and juicy things, then we would like just go there. We try never to leave. And then in those places we can really figure out the whole larger scheme of relativity, because you know we can't relate much to other beings because we don't bang into them and we don't touch them. You know, the body, the human body especially, is very interlockable with other bodies, you know, very much built for relationality. That's why, and completely deprogrammable and reprogrammable. Anybody can become a mass murderer, and a demon, or an angel and a saint. And the human sort of is the middle place between that, depending on what they cultivate. And why, when a being becomes truly what I call an evolutionary being, whereas they realize that every moment they're evolving one direction or another, there's no idling. The engine of evolution never idles, to borrow a phrase from Wittgenstein. And so then one becomes super conscious of like everything one does and tries to make it all beneficial at whatever level, right? So there's a reason we're here, kind of. In other words, that's why it's better to be here than some Brahma body deity. There are 16 levels in the form realm, according to the Buddhist science, cosmology. 16 levels in the form realm of different, what they call Brahma Kayika Devas, bodies with Brahma bodied bodies, deities. But they like just loaf around. They don't go at 5 o'clock for, you know, personal practice, Mysore style, house, bed, oh, sleepy, where's my coffee? You don't need that. They just lounge around like a bunch of golden energy whales. And then they say, oh yeah, well, someday I'll become a Buddha somewhere, maybe. Yeah. That Buddha's cool, he likes him. Head Brahma likes him. etc. But then there's a, then when you get in the zone, when you're doing whatever you really love to do, when you get into the zone, then you have a kind of bliss where you're interacting with all sorts of things, and the blissfulness that you feel overrides whatever irritations are present. So non-duality really is looking for that. I mean, I don't know whether either is truly possible, since I haven't attained them, at least not in my own awareness. I might be one of those beings who did attain and then purposely forgot about it in another life in order to be more stupid again. I mean, I don't know. I might be. But that doesn't do me any good. Tantric yoga does, which they call it Vajra repetition or Vajra recitation, Vajra japa. And then they include, there are three moments in the breath. There's the moment when the when you've inhaled, and then where you, before you turn to exhale. So there's a pause there. And that pause is amplified. And in that pause, they say, is the plane of speech. And you know, that's the red ah. We might do that together. And then you, so when the breath doesn't move, then discursive thought doesn't move. So there's a moment of nirvikalpa, actually, when the breath doesn't move. Even though it feels uncomfortable to hold that, and then it overrides, just like it's uncomfortable to hold the breath and one wants to get some air, some oxygen. But vikalpa, which means mental construction, you know, like discursive thought, goes with breath, so when you hold it, it doesn't flow. The amount of the thinking is not there, so the thinking diminishes. There's still subtle energy movement, and that may enable thought, which will dislodge that holding. And of course, if one holds one breath too extremely, without first having undone the granthas, you know, what yogis call the granthas, the knots in the central nervous system, then you'll just choke and whatever, have a spasm or something. But if you have opened the central nervous system and the central channel, the avaduti channel, sushumna channel, the different names for it, then you enter the central channel. That's the ultimate goal. That goes through the ah sound. It has a ch at the end of it, and it's a long ah, and it's ruby color. So I would say that is where you kind of are approaching a kind of non-discursive experience, non-conceptual experience of something in the holding. But basically, you shouldn't privilege that in the sense that all three are equally emptiness.
Greetings and salutations, podcast wallahs. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. This two-part podcast was originally recorded at the annual Buddha and the Yogis Buddhism and Yoga Retreat for All Levels held at Menla Retreat and Dewa Spa with Robert Thurman, Richard Freeman, and Mary Taylor. To learn more about this annual All Levels program, please visit menla.us. The first half of this week's episode included an in-depth exploration of the definition of mind in Buddhist inner sciences and how it relates to yoga practices, emptiness, and compassion. In the second half of this week's episode, we'll continue that discussion, and I hope you'll stay tuned at the end, for afterwards, Gary Gock returns. returns with a reading of poetry by Wallace Stevens. We hope you enjoy these poetry segments, and please be sure to share on all your favorite social media platforms. The Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House US membership community and listeners like you. Your weekly subscriptions, downloads, comments, and shares help support this podcast and the Tibet House mission of presenting and preserving Tibetan culture in New York City and in upstate New York at Menla Retreat. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, including discounts on tuition, purchases at the Tibet House US gift shop, and VIP invites to special events with His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Dossett tours with Robert Thurman led by Geographic Expedition. To learn more about these Dossett tours with Robert Thurman and Geographic Expedition, including trips to Bhutan in 2019, please visit tibethouse.us. The music for the Bob Thurman Podcast is generously supplied by Tenzin Chogyal. To learn more about the work and music of Tenzin Chogyal, please visit his website at tenzinchogyal.com. And now, back to the second half of this week's episode with Bob and Poetry by Gary Gock.
That you see, you could say it's like a orthodox belief in the primary level of Buddhism, is belief in causality. And remember, I said why? Because causality means relationship, and which everything we observe is caused. And then, therefore, but our ignorance and our delusion is that there's something essential about us that is uncaused. Which you see, if you put your focus on that. And you have nirvikalpa on that. What is your good name? You asked that question.
Robin.
So if you put your focus on that sense of yourself as something separate from everything else, and then you nirvikalpa become one pointed where you don't think, then you naturally will have an experience of being absolutely separate from everything. Then that will be a kind of bliss if you don't like, you know, washing dishes and, you know, whatever. Some problems in life. And there's a kind of happiness or a joyfulness in that, maybe, but it's boring and lonely too. Long time. Might not be the higher bliss of which things are made. It's an attempt to escape from interconnection. And emptiness means there is no escape from interconnection. And it's more, if you take it more radically, it means everything is empty of anything separate. And it means we are empty of being anything separate. We are all just interfolded with each other, in fact. And other beings and physical objects and things. Okay? So, who sees the inexorable causality of things just means that that's someone who has achieved a kind of level where they kind of, you know, they've had this kind of funny slippage of that sense that, you know, the sort of central core program, you know, the CPU of their being at the heart level, the heart chakra, is like wrapped around some kind of unchanging, permanent, absolute little thing, which is their identity. And they've had some experiences where that has seemed to slip. And they have not repressed or gotten in denial about that. That slippage actually gave a certain ease. And they had a moment of actually pleasure at that sense of slippage, but also fear. And then, but they didn't act on the fear of sort of clamping it down and then like living in denial, but in a way they had a slight visceral experience of selflessness, you could say. Okay? So this is someone who's had a little bit that and is not in denial, and therefore sees the inexorable causality of things. And among things, the word for things here is the word dharma, actually. Because the word dharma, the great masters in India, great sages and scholars, they are 11 meanings of dharma in the Sanskrit dictionary. And the most basic one is a thing. And just a cipher, you know. And it could be a thing like a liberation. My liberation, if I'm looking for one, I'm thinking I'm going to find that. On my nirvana, I'm going to find that nirvana. So at some level, although mediated indeed by concepts, but anyway, even nirvana is a thing when we use the word or when we think about it. So it's a dharma in the sense that it has its own characteristic. And so causality of things, so that's why they can say things of both psychic life and liberation. So here is within Buddhism, now they're not critiquing a Vedantin idea of an ultimate state being a separation from everything, but they're critiquing a notion of liberation of a dualist Buddhist, Theravada person or Hinayana person. There are other branches of Hinayana than Theravada, who thinks that they've got a nirvana that they got, and they tasted it, and then after they die, they'll go back there. They might hang out now for a while on sort of this momentum, habit momentum, but they've seen where they're going, and it's a place apart, and they're stuck on that. And because they've seen it, and they feel other people haven't, they're a little bit devil may care in their sort of residual life. They tend to be, you know? Tend to be like, oh well, I'm different. They know they're going there, so in a way, they're like a good old modern materialist who are sure they're going to be not exist. As far as relating to anything, there'll be no consequence. So therefore, they can do whatever they like, you know, destroy the planet if necessary to have more electricity in their gambling casino in Las Vegas. Unfortunately, those dualist Buddhists, those are kinds of Buddhists like that that they're criticizing, who just want wisdom, just want their own self liberation, and they feel they can't do anything about anybody else's. There's this term I always share with people because I love it so much, from what are called in modern times sociologists of knowledge. It's like a certain group of people. And they have this thing, when we see something, we see it as possessing massive facticity. I love that. It's like you see a stone wall, or you see a stone, and that stone is really there. It's the stone that really gets you. Has massive facticity because we have an objectivity conviction about it. But here, all objectivity convictions are weakened or destroyed or eroded when you really see the inexorable causality of everything. And even there, that would be an objectivity conviction about your being in a state apart from everything, free of suffering for yourself. That we would have, that would not be as something that would be intrinsically objective. It would be something notional, perhaps, that would be inspiring for someone who is in pain and agony, just like an anesthetic is inspiring when you break something. But you don't have an objectivity conviction about it. I think that's a successful term. Anyway, so this means when you have, and here, you know, I could kind of share, like, have a little tiny taste of this. When you have an experience of sort of disappearing, that seems like a visceral, powerful thing. You're like, you really disappear. You're really not there any longer. You don't, like, you don't recognize a voice that's saying, oh, hey, Bob, what's happening? What happened to you? Or something. You don't recognize that. If you have a taste of that, and then you feel you're in a space that's really the real thing, because it's just different from every other thing you have experienced as your real self experiencing really other things. So you and the other things and that duality disappears and you just have a spaced out experience. And when you do, you tend to think that fits what I thought the absolute should be. Something apart. Wow, I really felt it. And then you come back into the relation and then it's sort of problematic. And there are different ways of interpreting what happened. You don't even, when you do it, you don't even think you might come back. You don't care. You don't think you might. It's like those people in the near-death thing who are not really looking to be reborn. It's a really boring person like G. Jesus, or so Jesus' lawyer tells them, you got to go back, it's not your time, you know, like, you have to go do this and that, you know, and then they go back into their broken by an auto accident body. You know, some of the near-death people have that kind of thing. So then there's this duality thing. Well, there's now, you know, when I'm back, I realize everything here is all interrelated because I've sort of isolated the big there of the absolute as elsewhere. So as long as I think those two are different, they're separate. And then what happens is they call when you return to relational thing, which you didn't necessarily expect to do, and that's where there's a certain courage involved in letting go. But then when you come back, then they call that the dreamlike aftermath, samadhi. Actually, it's also samadhi, they say, once you have samadhi. And you have the space-like equipoise samadhi, and then the dreamlike aftermath samadhi. And then when you have the dreamlike aftermath samadhi, as you get back to you, back in meat space, in other words, then you get more and more into your old habit of attributing massive facticity to everything. It gets restored. And then you realize, oh no, I'm getting carried away now on my old intrinsic reality habit and intrinsic identity habit, and I better go meditate, and then you meditate, and then you rehearse this disappearing thing again, and then you sort of oscillate back and forth, and there is a way of doing the path where then this oscillation is supposed to kind of get smaller and smaller to where then they can begin to get where it's like a mirror image, and the surface of the mirror is the space, the empty space, and the dreamlike illusory appearances and differentiations and relativities are that space, on the surface of it, isn't it? And you're kind of aware of them two together. That's sort of the way he's saying. But there is a certain type of person who doesn't need to do that kind of oscillation too much. And it's much more rapid for them not to, because then if they more quickly recognize that although it's illusion-like and dreamlike, the post-space-like equipoise samadhi experience world, then they mature their compassion more rapidly because they have a degree of their absolute concern, you could say, their sense of absolute drive, their intensity of that, is now connected to these illusory appearances and illusory things. So then the quality of them becomes all important to them. There's a wonderful verse that I love to cite in the Samadhi Raja Sutra, King of Samadhi Sutra, which says, who truly understands causality, when they could have said relativity, but it didn't happen to say causality, soon understands emptiness. And whoever understands emptiness becomes mindful of the most insignificant things. So instead of whoever understands emptiness takes off, launches, and goes to Mars with Elon and Jeff and Richard Branson, you know, they're all desperately running away trying to go to their notion of nirvikalpa. Nirvikalpa for billionaires. And they think it's going to be on Mars. So why it becomes? Because the absolute becomes whether every relative thing is a little better or a little worse. Because a little better in the flow of causality has infinite consequence. And a little worse has infinite consequence. Now, since reality is beginningless, just because there are cycles of local universes, there's no limit to it. And infinity, that means there's no one universe. There are many. And so there's always life everywhere. And because of that, infinite numbers of people have already become fully enlightened, already have this non-dual thing, and they are operating with infinite concern for all beings. No one of them is in control of everything, but they're totally worrying about everything, let's say. And so there's where we begin to get a cosmological sense, which we have to let go of. We shouldn't have an objectivity conviction about it, but on a relational way, we can feel a little better. We can smile about the idea of, you know, the nirvanic substance of the samsara. In the sense of substance, you know, standing under it, or in the sense of actually being the weave of You follow me? So it's the goodwill of those beings. And then I have a formula that I used to jokingly say I was going to patent, which I failed to do, but nobody wants it anyway. But my formula is, because people, when they get into emptiness, they really get into like, yeah, but well, what makes it compassion? Why is it good? You know? Who cares about it? I mean, it all disappears. You know, you have to let go. So who says that makes it good? Wisdom, like, you know? Because they think of like this inanimate nothing, they always, their mind goes to inanimate nothingness, because that's what our culture tells us is underlying everything. And we've grown up with that, actually. And it's a consensus, it's a collective vibe, you know, it's morphic resonance with all the people that we all have. And so the bad guys are wrapped around their sense of absolute separate self. And therefore they're very much unhappier and frustrated. But they think by dominating others, or you know, they have all kinds of things they think are methods to get less frustrated and less pissed off and less irritated and less anxious and, you know, hyper. And then they, whatever those things that they do are the wrong things to do, so they get more static back from aggressing against the world. And then they become demons, and then they get into sadism and torture and weird, crazy demon things. But they, and there's an infinite number of them, because the world's beginningless and they're infinite beings. That was, so it could be really bad. But there's also an infinite number of good guys. Girls, too, especially. Back in Ijala. The network of decades. And they are drawing their energy from everybody else's needs. The bad guys are drawing their energy from their own sense of their absolute need, only one. So, infinity times one is less than infinity to the infinite power. Because the ones who are motivated by everybody else's energy and need are so much more powerful, toe-to-toe, with the bad one who's just out for themselves. Because even if they're big and fat, and you know, have like weird hairdos and whatever, they're like pathetic, sad creatures. Okay? So that's my point. In case people get like worried that we're all going to be doomed by all the infinite numbers, there are lots of demons. And, you know, people know that. Look at those motorcycle gangs, they paint demons on their thing, you know. On their jackets, you know. I have some great demon shirts. Okay, when they coincide, but here's what to do. When they coincide, not alternating, mere sight of inevitable relativity secures knowledge beyond objectivism, and investigation of the realistic worldview is perfected. And this is really, now the most intelligent being, what they call the jewel-like student, or practitioner, or bodhisattva, is the one who gets that. And who therefore sort of gets an inference where they realize the mirror nature, the mirror surface nature of even their sense of meat space. So the mere sight of inevitable relativity means that even I see something as if it had mass effecticity, and I think, oh, that's objectively over there. I'm having that kind of same experience, even though I had a slippage in some meditation once, you know, and I disappeared, and that was actually kind of groovy, and then I didn't even know if I was coming back, but I did, and then once I came back, I started being habitual again, and then I got really into that. But then when I feel I really am habitual, I felt that I'm habitual. So by feeling it, it's relational. If you had a self that was not relational, you wouldn't be irrelevant to you. It would drop out, as they say, you know, because if it couldn't relate, so you couldn't experience being it. You could not. It would not be the agent of your knowing, because everything you know, it changes with what you know. Right? Subject-object interactions. So if it has no object, if it has no subject, it's no object, it's meaningless to say it's a subject. Okay? It has no meaning. That's all, it's really, it's not rocket science. So the one who understands that, you see, then they equip themselves with what is called the royal reason of relativity. And it's a royal, because it's the royal medicine of relativity. It's the royal balm of emptiness. That's why Nagarjuna says, emptiness is a medicine, a balm that heals all suffering. Except a person who takes that medicine as a and attaches their objectivity conviction to emptiness and thinks emptiness is the real thing. And then it becomes a poison. And then there's no cure for it because they're stuck on what would be their medicine. Do you follow? They say that. Nagarjuna says that. So then they say, but anyway, the one who understands that secures knowledge beyond objectivism and investigation of the view is perfected. And here's where I say that the feminine mind has a better approximation of enlightenment than the masculine one. Because the feminine mind, which is a body mind, all minds are ultimately really body minds, like you are in a dream. You have that body in a dream that sees things and hears things. So the body is just the five senses and the sixth sense organizing mental sense inside the five senses, in the center of the nervous system of the five senses. And so the body mind of the female is more naturally alert to interconnection than the male. And enlightenment has been all falsely defined by the Western Brahmins, bunch of chauvinist dorks, as some state of separation. And some Indian dorks have come over from their high caste, you know, having lost track of this, although it's, that sweetness is totally in their culture. But still, to some of them, you know, they get a little like stiff, you know, stiff shirt, what do you call it? Like stuffed shirt, stiff shirt. Stuffed dhoti. And they come over, and then they all have a glorious, like, you know, male disconnect of time. Holy, holy, holy. Right? And their wives and other people are out there, like, trying to prepare the food and so on, and hoping that they won't become too holy to help carry out the garbage when it's heavy. So that's the thing. The relativity thing, so the royal reason, but the royal reason of relativity, this is what is fascinating about Vikalpa. Vikalpa is necessary for inference. And the royal reason of relativity means that all things are empty of any separate intrinsicity or essence because they are made of causes of their parts and pieces, and you know, and when you keep taking apart, no core, it disappears. Which only the quantum people found out lately. Only, you know, and okay, I only found that, and I don't want to sidetrack in that. Okay? So, the female has, but if you redefine enlightenment as this greater interconnectedness, and Buddhahood is the being that is infinitely interconnected in a loving manner with all existence, then the female's way ahead. Thank you. Thank you very much. But when they coincide, so therefore this reason, if you do it, can save a lot of oscillating, that's what I'm saying. If you get the roots, you get the reason. And also, it's a considered protection against the seduction of separation. Like my original guru, Dhanji, bless his heart, Dhanji Ledin Sanimete, he made me so pissed off when I was first studying with him. Because it was like the Dharma was exploding in golden letters of Tibetan and Sanskrit in my mind. And he was reading these texts to me. So I was learning his language. And then I wanted to run away and meditate. And then every time I was meditating, I would very quickly get like sort of head toward the outer body. Certainly, as a highly anxious like 20-year-old, 21-year-old, you know. A fakir, a sadhu, you know. And he would show up, pound on the door of my little cubicle or wherever, find me out in the bush when I started running away and get behind the tree if I wanted to, like, go there. You know? He would show up, like, what are you doing? Oh, meditating. Oh, that's a waste of time. You're not ready for that. You don't want to learn. And yeah, whatever it was, come have some yogurt, get out in the It's like, I thought it was just part of his thing about he didn't want me to be a monk. He was just totally, totally against me being a monk. And he said, oh, I know you want to be a monk. I know you want to meditate. You shouldn't be, because you won't be later. And it's embarrassing in our tradition. You can't quit. even though llamas are, because taking the excuse of the exile, you know, and the invasion, which is a good excuse. But I was so bummed, but he saved me, I think. I could have gone and I could have gotten stuck somewhere. And then what happens? Your mind really slows down and you're wanting to really care about every little thing. It's like, well, what? Who cares, you know? So I can leave. I can take off any time. And then that's you lose compassion. Then, although it seems you're cool, you then actually, your larger evolution toward a really enlightened state slows way down. Mm. They say. So that's the Messian view is perfect, but then it's a beautiful, and then actually in Tantra, the great Tibetan masters, this is something that I haven't found in any Indian source text, but there must be. The great Indian tantric masters were amazing also, and wrote so many books, too, but in Tibetan ones, that this ability to hold a paradox in the mind, like relativity, even the relativity even of the experience of an absolute, even if the feeling of I experienced the absolute, but by holding in the mind that in for the inference, then there is a kind of a defense of being seduced by the seeming absoluteness of the experience. Because I'm experiencing it's relative. That becomes like second nature. That's where then the mirror surface and the coinciding of your somatic state imagined as a separation, and your yoga, and your downward dog, your upward dog, your whatever it is, and then later the different body that you start having with chakras and things, if you want to go in that direction, go to that extent with it. And all of that has to be emptiness to work. And you have to be aware of the emptiness of your actual meat space body in order to really develop the power of imagination, which is vikalpa. Kalpa means to build something. No, kalp means the verb root kalp means to build. And so, and vikalpa means to build discerningly. Vi means, you know, dividingly. And so you have to build yourself a new body. That's like Mez and Buddha or Vajrasattva or Shiva or Shakti or whatever it is. And you won't really realistically be able to do that until you realize that you're building your body now as it is. But now it seems to go automatic. And this is the big difference in Buddhist psychological science to Western one, which thank goodness the Westerners finally got one with Mr. Freud and company. But the Westerners think that the subconscious is automatically necessarily there. It's like the main part of the body of the iceberg, and the conscious mind is just the tip and all of this. And that does describe accurately, from the Buddhist scientific point of view for thousands of years, what the unenlightened person is like, driven by this huge seething bunch of impulses. But therefore, the goal of the practitioner, and it is the same in India too, all of the Indic traditions, Jainism, so Vaishnavism, Shaivism, better than say Shaktism, better than say Hinduism, which is just basically all of them. So they're all into creating a better reality, another reality. But then there are many who divert and get seduced by some sort of absolute experience that then makes the world unimportant. And then the world doesn't change. But India was not, that was the exception rather than the rule in India. The proof being the vulnerability of the country. A bunch of nations that had defeated Alexander the Great, the unconquerable Macedonian phalanx, and all pumped up with Iranian soldiers and Africans and Egyptians and whoever it was, defeated them. But 1,000 years later, or you know, 1,300 years later, they were trampled by a bunch of weirdos on camels. Mm-hmm. Not nearly as forceful as Alexander, probably. That proves that they really understood this, that the rule was that they weren't so seduced by that in either any form of Hinduism or Jainism or Buddhism, because they were more gentle, they were more connected, they were choosing to live interrelatedly and more happily, knowing their vulnerability actually, and with the tremendous wealth that they had, they naturally attracted people wanting to conquer them, and the latest bunch being the Brits, well, the Portuguese, Dutch, Brits. Okay. So then the only place left was Tibet for a while. and then the Tibetans, and little pockets out everywhere. I mean, you know, and then the Tibetans went and they did this poor things to the Mongolians, who used to be pretty rough, and they became vulnerable in this last century. Anyway, now we're all vulnerable. Fortunately, nobody can conquer anybody. People can think they do, but and they can destroy, but no one can conquer. I really think that's arguable.
There's a poet named Wallace Stevens who lived from 1879 to 1955, whose first book was tremendously influential on the great poets of his age. And he didn't assume a persona the way other poets did. He worked as an insurance executive. He'd walk to work, and as he did so, he'd compose a poem in his mind and come to work, take off his coat, pick up the dictating machine, and say to his secretary, "I'd like you to take down the idea of order at Key West," and he'd speak the poem. He was never quite popular, also, besides his lack of self-promotion, because he had a sophisticated vocabulary with sometimes an upper-class tone. His wife posed for the Liberty Dime. But enough of that. I'd like to read a poem, a great Zen poem, which he wrote in 1921, from the point of view of a persona who has never been written about in that way before, from the point of view of the snow man. The snow man. One must have a mind of winter to regard the frost and the boughs of the pine trees crusted with snow, and have been cold a long time to behold the junipers shagged with ice, the spruces rough in the distant glitter of the January sun, and not to think of any misery in the sound of the wind, in the sound of a few leaves, which is the sound of the land, full of the same wind that is blowing in the same bare place for the listener, who listens in the snow, and nothing himself beholds, nothing that is not there, and the nothing that is. The listener who listens in the snow and nothing himself beholds, nothing that is not there, and the nothing that is. I'm Gary Gough, and this poetry segment is a part of the Bob Thurman podcast and is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal.